Hello, I'm Dan from GAK Pro Audio, and I'm here with James Wilshire from the Freemasons and F9 Audio for a very special edition of the GAK podcast. This is James's Desert Island Synths. So, here we are in your studio. We are literally surrounded by pretty much every single synth I could think of wanting to own.
Well, I'd like to think that all the manufacturers are highly represented here.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, there is. Yes, it's quite an Aladdin's cave of everything from a little Yamaha PSS 470 to all the way up to the big synths, the Jupiters, Oberheims, and so on. So I imagine it's going to be pretty difficult for you to pare this down to just half a dozen of your favourites to take away.
No, I know what I'd like to take away, definitely.
Right. Pretty straightforward then.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you want me to start?
Yeah, where would you go? So no particular order, just...
The first one has to be the beginning of modern synthesis, the Moog Model D. And I'm very lucky to have a mid-70s one. It's in beautiful condition. It always turns on and does great things. There's never been a problem with it, touch wood. And oddly, that was actually sold to me by another synthesizer legend, you could say. It's the guy who designed the Oscar.
Oh, wow.
Sold me that. He's an industrial designer. And he'd had that from new, I think, and told me all sorts of stories about the company behind the Oscar. So it's kind of got a dual history, really.
Excellent. Well, yeah, every time I see you seem to have uncovered another gem somewhere from a vein in a mine that I wish I knew the entrance to, let's say that. So what is it? What is it about the Model D in particular that you love?
I still remember the first time I really got to grips with one, and most importantly, it's modulation options. It's oscillator modulation and the filter modulation. It's where all the crazy effects come from that you just know a Moog for. Everyone kind of always says it's the solid sound again, but for me, it's the craziness. It's the fact that once you actually start moving it and playing it, it is an instrument. It's not a synthesizer. And I think it was one of the most perfect designs because, to be honest, the design is still replicated even in software today. Every time that you see anything that's replicating analog waveforms, there's normally some kind of Moog history behind it. And it just sounds like nothing else.
Well, it always has been a benchmark. You know, it's and whenever a new synth comes out, it's always, oh, it sounds a bit like a Moog, or it always have a Moog sound on it. It is one of the sounds that has become the Moog oscillator filter combination is to synthesis what the Fender Strat going through a Marshall amp is.
Yeah, or
music.
the Les Paul Custom.
Exactly.
It's a perfect circuit design that probably has never been bettered. But also it's the simplicity of the circuit design. You've got real big, fat, old 60s and 70s components sat behind it. And that's why Moog are still taking that incredibly seriously today. So the heritage from that machine is still completely covered in all of the new machines. And there's very few times that you see something come through with that amount of history and still be completely current. And particularly as you see music's now, suddenly everyone's got interested again in modular synths and real synthesis again.
Indeed.
And basically hardware, it becomes even more important now.
How do you think it when you put it next to your Voyager, will you always reach for the Model D?
Yeah, or? Absolutely. I do love the Voyager, don't get me wrong, but it's a completely different synth. It's a modern synth with all sorts of... It's very controlled. It's almost like... you know, you see those programs of domesticated wild cats living in people's houses. Well, that's the Voyager. That's the lion in the wild.
what an excellent analogy. Yeah, I was lucky enough to have a Voyager and always found it a pleasure. And whenever I've been in contact and been lucky enough to get my hands on a Mini Moog of any kind, it does come across more as an instrument than any other keyboard out there. Arguably, its nuances is more like a guitar or a violin or something
in terms
of the precision and the
well,
and
it's
the
designed to be played as opposed to, because you have to remember at the time when the Moogs first came out, the Musicians Union were totally up in arms saying, well, you can't do this, you're going to put live musicians out of work, and they were literally trying to get synthesizers banned.
Literally, yeah.
So with the backdrop of all of that, the history behind it is so important that Bob Moog himself felt he had to create this perfect instrument. And as I say, some of the performance controls, I mean, it's the mod wheel, the two mod wheels on the side of that are still replicated in pretty much every synth.
Well, it was kind
keyboard
of
controller.
It was kind of like the almost like the Model T Ford of synthesizers. The topology of the front panel, as you rightly say, with the mod wheels on the left-hand side, and the flow of the circuitry from the oscillators, modulators, then leading through to the mixer, then the filters, and the envelopes at the end has become the topology for the front panel of synthesizers since then.
Yeah.
It's like that workflow of subtractive synthesizers. It was the first car that had clutch, brake, accelerator in those positions and weren't all flywheels and this, that and the other. It was that one.
Yes,
that
because before,
since then everybody has kind of followed that form, arguably.
Yeah, absolutely. And bearing in mind it is just basically a cut down version of his modular synths, and that is what Bob Moog, the components inside and the actual controls on a Mini Moog are basically almost what Bob Moog would consider to be his Desert Island modular.
Right.
That's just the components that he thought were the best for to creating a whole gamut of, you know, the whole collection of sounds that you can get out of a Moog system. But as I say, for me, it's the craziness. Once you start with the cross-modulation of using oscillator 3 to cross-modulate the other oscillators and the filters, that's when all the banana stuff comes out that no one really knows the Moog does. Because when you first turn it on, you're like, oh, it's gone slightly out of tune, or I can't use that. But when you start to play with that, that's when the chaos occurs. It's
genius. Once you start modulating from that third oscillator, the frequencies that it can get up to are quite crazy. Pure science fiction and always an absolute pleasure. Well, that's that probably covers the mini Moog there, the Model D. So where do you go from there? There's a lot of heavy hitters around.
Well, let's go completely to the other end of the spectrum, and I'm very lucky to have one of a synth that only 250 were made.
I thought it was 500.
Sorry?
I thought it was 500 they made.
I've heard 250. Right.
The less the better.
The less the better, obviously. But there's even less working now because it was effectively a computer inside a beautiful-looking interface. The guy, again, who designed it was an industrial designer and completely obsessed with how the interaction between someone using a piece of equipment and actually getting to the sound source. He also developed the Andromeda, and we're talking about a synth called the Hartmann Neuron. It came out mid-90s, was an absolute financial disaster because at that point all anyone wanted was kind of nice piano sounds and strings for some reason.
Indeed.
But it was the first keyboard ever, in fact the only keyboard ever, to have a version of a neural network inside, processing a whole series of sample sources and allowing you to almost cross-modulate between them. And then, so instead of raw analog waveforms, we're talking actually about digital samples here. The front panel is absolutely stunning. It's one of the most unpredictable instruments I've ever owned, and also when you actually start to look at what's inside it, one of the most shockingly built from a technical point of view.
Indeed. Yeah, I was very grateful to you a few years ago when you allowed me to become custodian of your Hartmann for a few weeks. And when you switch this thing on, it is an event. It's not like flicking a little switch and then getting a sound. It's the whole process of it, the whole sound of it, the whole feeling around the board is very, very special and unique. And as you rightly say, the architecture of it is completely unique.
Yeah.
And quite kind of difficult to explain and conceptualize the way that it models and makes an interpretation of audio rather than working in a linear way.
The best way to look at it is that you can take one particular sound source and you can tear across it in 3D space. If you could imagine a sound in 3D, you can actually draw from one point to another whilst the actual two samples are playing back. Now, one very important thing to get clear, there was no time stretch involved back then, so you're not actually able to change the timing of the sounds behind it, but you can literally rip through sounds.
Yeah.
And then the way that these two sound sources, there's two basically, effectively oscillators, I've forgotten what they're actually called, they've got their own terminology within the system, and then big digital effects system. But what I quite enjoyed finding out just recently, because this is the way I use it, Hans Zimmer has one that he still uses for basic composition. Doesn't always use the resulting files within the project, but he finds that he comes up with different notes actually by using it, which is why I mention it here, because every time I've used it, you really get excited again about the possibilities of sometimes even the same old chords you've been playing for years.
Indeed, yeah, you find it is a true voyage of exploration when you're on using that synth, and it is, you're absolutely right, the antithesis to the Model D, in the sense that it's an exploration conceptually, and it encourages different ways of playing, and because of the way that the very, very dynamic keyboard interacts with some of the parameters as well, it can take you in some incredible directions, from bowed pianos to, you know, even the very simple when it's trying to sound like a rompler, it has a halo around it, which is just, it's just very, very special. It's a very special sound.
And then you move
sound.
One of the pots or one of the sort of XY controllers in any direction, and then suddenly it's back into chaos again. And that, as you rightly say, linked with the expressiveness of the keyboard, the aftertouch and the performance controls, means that you have a completely unique instrument that you're never, ever going to get. As soon as you can load up a preset and it will come back the same, but the moment you touch anything, that's it, it's gone. It's completely off into its own.
You can't adjust one parameter at once on it effectively, because it's like you touched on earlier, it makes effectively a model of the sound rather than a linear sample, like a 3D model, so you adjust one parameter and several different aspects of the sound are changed, and trying to get that back, if you like, you can't just dial a knob in and then dial it back and it be the same thing on there.
No.
Getting the same thing out of it twice is an exercise in futility.
And that's why I love it, because it's a great thing to actually pull up and to, you know, we live in a world where even the best digital synths now, the best VSTs are trying to, they have a randomness about them, but it's almost a controlled randomness, whereas things like this, much more instrument-led, just allow you to actually create things that you never knew you were going to make when you actually went in to do it. And that, to me, is what's missing sometimes in the kind of semi-sterile world.
Indeed, and it is one of those machines that it almost has a death clock built into it. These things aren't going to be around for very long, because essentially it's a 386 PC.
Well, it's basically a Pentium board inside. At one stage, the capacitors on the Pentium board are going to go, because let's face it, no one designed motherboards for PCs to last more than probably 10 years. So the fact that it's even still around and functioning means it's doing well. Every now and again, it kind of wets itself and thinks that it's still got, but it should have a keyboard connected to it, an actual PC keyboard. So sometimes it won't even boot, and you've got to then connect a screen up to it and say, right, you know, you're absolutely fine, carry on, off you go. Then it's fine for about another 4 months, and then it will do it again. So, yeah, it's one of those things that got to get as much out of it as possible in the coming 5 years, or dig around for new old stock Pentium boards.
They come up occasionally. This is one of
the world's oldest disk drives.
Yeah, indeed. And it even has USB on it, though, doesn't it? It was one of the first devices.
Yeah, it does.
I
mean, you can load your own samples. No, it's got network onto it, so you can load your own samples on it with a program, but you need a very old operating system-based computer to actually do it. I think I've got an old Mac around that does it. Never actually tried it, but I'd love to get some vocals in there and see what happens, because I think that's going to be brilliant. But it's a massive mission to do it, and at the moment, I just don't have time.
Yes, well, I can't imagine you having much time with all the stuff that's around us. So, from a bona fide original analog classic to a very obscure 90s digital synthesizer in the Hartmann Neuron, where do we go from there?
Well,
number three,
we've got to talk about the beauty that is, well, also one of the most well-known synthesizers in the world, the Jupiter 8. Now there's been tons said about this, but the way I would like to describe it is, I was running a couple of pages the other day that had some standard kind of 80s orientated synthesizer work on them, particularly a nice snappy funky bass, and it was doing the kind of nice big almost new disco sound. The moment that I then dragged the Jupiter 8 out and plugged it in, now bearing in mind there's one thing you have to remember with all hardware, is that it doesn't sound big when you plug it straight in. The key to it is that you have to process it in the same way that those synths were processed back in the day to get them to sound good. So it's a kind of complete reverse of the situation where if you put an audio unit or a VST up, that it comes in and it's designed to sound nice, big and clever, but they very rarely have any life in them. The moment you replace it with something like a Jupiter 8 and you preamp it properly, you EQ it properly and you compress it properly, when you then play it back, the only way I can describe it is it suddenly sounds like a record. It just comes alive. It's another instrument. It's a big polysynth, and it's digitally controlled, so it's kind of, the tuning is fairly stable. but there is still a randomness to it and a beauty to it and an air to it that makes everything that you do with it sound like a record.
Yeah, they're always a pleasure to behold and a pleasure to interact with the big dupes. And I also quite like it because you can burn yourself on it.
Yeah, it gets so hot at the back and it smells like an old Commodore 64
or Scale X-Trix to a certain extent. It's not a proper synthesizer, ladies and gentlemen, unless you can burn yourself on it. But now put that in your book. I always remember the pleasures of listening to it in stereo. So you're running the two outputs in the dual mode.
Yeah.
So you have effectively a layer of the same patch on top of each other and then run them left and right. And that's just like having a bath in analog, gorgeous sound. The only real problem I ever had with the Jupiter 8 was when I get to, I think it's in the original preset bank A68, and it's the bass sound that Harold Faltermeyer used in the movie Fletch and Beverly Hills Cop. And if I get to that sound, I just start playing the bass line from Beverly Hills Cop, and that's as far as I get with that particular project, and that's it. That's my only issue with the Jupiter 8. Other than that, it's always a pleasure. The modulation section where the pitch and mod stick in has got more hardware in terms of sliders and knobs and switches on it than a lot of other very nice synthesizers have on the whole face of them. Plus, obviously, you can get into the land of strange with it, with the cross modulation.
I wish there was a kind of a bit more control to be able to repitch that back in, because it will just tear into any pitching that you've got when that starts to happen. But then that's always kind of offset by the beauties of the pulse width modulation.
Indeed.
Of the synth, which is just, if you want to know how all those early 80s lead sounds were made all over kind of any alternative music, then dig into that. It's fantastic.
And the solo in I Want to Break Free by Queen. Not Brian May. A Jupiter 8, in fact.
Really?
Indeed, yeah. Listen to that again and you'll go...
It's quite surprising when you actually record one and you look at the waveforms, because if you're used to working, as I have been over the last few years, with a lot of plugins, it doesn't look very powerful and it looks quite ragged and it looks a bit all over the place. But this is where we've now come to a point where we stupidly tend to judge sounds by what they look like. And we don't listen to music with our eyes. We listen to all music with our ears. And I've had a few people even say, well, you can't use that. Look at the state of the waveform. No, listen to it. It's fantastic. Yeah. And the fact that it is moving is what makes it sound so cool.
I found that when trying to sample it, particularly in stereo. And you think, okay, well, you'll get a loop out of it. There's a few cycles and away you go. And you're just to find a crossover point or a match, particularly when you're running a separate signal left and right, was
near on impossible.
Exactly. Well, yeah, there's not much more to say about the Jupiter 8. It's one of the classic synthesizers, been on more famous recordings, right up there with the Model D.
It's a poly instrument. It sounds like an actual instrument, and it's when you start playing it, it's designed to play as opposed to be programmed.
Indeed, and yeah, a pleasure. Should you be able to be lucky enough to get your hands on one or even own one, and but certainly a bit of a backbreaker moving it around, but I guess if you had one you'd want to keep it just exactly where it is,
as near as possible. But do, if you get a chance, do smell one once it's been off for a few hours, because there is nothing like it. It's, you're instantly taken back to the 1980s.
Indeed.
If you remember that era,
it's got definitely a Hornby kind of smell to it. Some train sets or Scale X-Trix or something going on there. And yeah, never pick it up off a stand if you don't know how to after a long time being on. Otherwise, yes. It's a bit like picking up a dropped motorcycle by the exhaust pipe.
The worst one I found for that just recently was the SP1200.
Right, okay.
I had absolutely no idea how hot the power supplies ran until I put my hand down the back of one to try and take the cable out.
This might be a good thread, cooking on synths. We could,
or more synth scars.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, show us your, if you could, log onto our Facebook and show us any synth-related injuries that you may have, burn marks from Jupiters, anything like that. Cook an egg on it. Let's have a look. Okay.
I need to come forward in time now, and One that it's from a legend in synthesizer history, but it's not one of the ones that he's more currently known for, and it's Dave Smith's Evolver, more accurately the Poly Evolver. And I still remember the very, very first time I heard one. Russell from the Freemasons is very good friends with Carl Cox. And Carl came in to play some new stuff he'd been working on in Australia. And a friend of his, he'd bought an Evolver. And there were these incredible sounds coming out of it. And I've been chasing one ever since. And I finally managed to get one about a year ago, one I really, really liked the look of. And it's a beauty. Again, it's an instrument in the fact that you go to any sound on it and you start just tweaking it, and all of a sudden that sound is completely different. And then when you look at the history, why, this is the man who invented the Prophet VS.
Well, his name is studied throughout synthesizer history, punctuates a lot of the great moments from various manufacturers. And we're very lucky that he's still now following his own star and producing some of the most interesting hybrid synthesizers, digital and analog, and still doing it and still providing us with interesting synths. It's like we've almost been waiting years and years for manufacturers to start making this kind of stuff, and of late we're in another golden age now, I think. Yeah. of people getting interesting and interested in synths and the manufacturers responding, but particularly the DSI range of instruments. It's been a real pleasure to see those coming out over the last few years. The Evolver is one that I've not had much contact with. So,
cut a long story short, four oscillators. So it's a similar architecture to the recent Prophet 12, or the mono version of that. But two of the oscillators are completely analog, and two of the oscillators are completely digital. And all of the Prophet VS's waveforms are in the digital oscillators. You've also got Curtis chips on the filters.
Indeed.
And it's got its classic, and it was it's his classic signal path, but with it was the beginning of the hack and decimate and girth controls and things like that. But pretty much the actual internal circuitry, from what I can gather, apart from certain bits that are in that beautifully crunchy digital form, are pretty much analog all the way through. And because of that, it's got a warmth to it and a depth, but it's still being completely digitally controlled, and a total madness to it as well with some of the feedback controls.
It's the modulation and the sequencing elements of the sounds as well, that you can get some incredible stuff.
When we did a Depeche Mode remix, and it was the only thing that we found really suited the kind of madness of sounds that you were having to try and create whilst we were putting stuff in from the hardware, because with Depeche Mode you do need to have a degree of things poking out and just being abstract and a bit different, and that was one of the ones. As soon as we started using that heavily on it, it just arrived around the time, the whole process became a lot easier.
As I said, I've not had a much up close and personal experience with the Evolver, particularly the Poly Evolver, but I know yourself and various other people are big fans of that product. And Dave Smith doing a great job still. And as we said, his name seems to punctuate a lot of the great moments in synthesis over the years. So a pleasure to be that he is still a vanguard in that area and still providing us with interesting new stuff. So from the Evolver.
Okay, so coming right forward now, for me, it's a company. The last one that I want to mention now is come from a company that I remember when their first a synth was ever put on the market. You can't miss the bright red livery, and it's Nord. And I've been lucky enough to work with Nord a little bit over the last few years. But for me, their defining synth for the last few years has been the Nord Lead 4. They pioneered the use of software models for creating analog-style sounds. But they've always had a particular oscillator model that's had its own personality as well.
It always had the most edge and was always the most analog-sounding. It was particularly the big birth of virtual analog. I found a lot of the other manufacturers kind of compensated with a bad oscillator sound by covering it with effects. And all of the original Nords just were raw, and they sounded more analog than any of the other VAs.
And you can get them to scream more than any other synth that I've known for years. And what I love about every Nord that comes through, and particularly the last two, the Nord Lead 4 and the Nord A1, is that when you look at the feature set, you're almost, when you take it out of the box, a bit disappointed, because you're used to VSTs and AUs having this ton of controls. Then you start to use it, and then you suddenly realise every single control has been massively thought about by a whole series of people at Nord, so that when it arrives and when it comes out of the box, it's perfect for what it's intended to do, but you can also push it to extremes really quite easily with a combination of factors. So from what seems like a simplistic panel, the moment you start programming it, you realise that you are actually swimming in an enormous ocean of sound. And it's phenomenal. I've never known anything be so perfectly simplistic. And I think their method of doing that needs to be replicated by an awful lot of other companies outside of just hardware as well. If we had some VSTs that had that level of kind of inbuilt simplicity, the world would be a much easier place for sound design. But the Nord Lead 4 is, to me, the most powerful hardware synth that I've used for years, without a shadow of a doubt, in the fact that you can quickly grab a sound, you may know the building blocks of what it should sound like initially, but then you start delving around into the modulation functions, and the even the built-in effects are all perfectly created to do exactly what they say on the tin. But you're not confronted by this enormous number of parameters, you're confronted by just the right amount of parameters for you to switch out of technical mode and get back into artistic mode incredibly quickly.
And the playability of them as well.
Yeah.
That's one of my favourite things about the Nord, the unique stone mod wheel and wooden pitch stick. The playability and the expression that you can get out of those are nothing like any other modulation, real-time modulation section in terms of pitch and mod on anything I've ever played.
No,
The pitch bend on the Nord, all the Nord keyboards, is more like a whammy bar on a guitar than, in terms of the way that you can use it and the expression that you can get into it, than any other mod wheel pitch bend that I've ever experienced.
Absolutely, and I love the fact that they've decided to bring organic and natural substances into a completely digital box.
Indeed. I believe all the mod pitch bends are tuned to A as well. If you twang a Nord pitch bend, they're all supposed to hit a perfect A, believe it or not.
Oh, that's
and
good.
I've tested that, and it does seem to be the case.
The only thing I would say with it, the mod wheel, though, they really could do with just a little extra software layer, because if you use it as a master keyboard, it is constantly writing in 0101 mod all the way through, which if you don't keep a little handle on, you can turn it off within the parameters, and it's worth actually doing that, because otherwise you can write in a ton of controller information into every performance without actually realising.
I recently replaced the mod wheel on my G2, Nord G2, which I would definitely have to cite as probably one of my favourite synths in the world. The sort of sandbox type modular system I'm still scraping the surface of after 10 years plus, and some of the things that guys come up with on that still amaze me. But yeah, the Nords are definitely almost to stand alone in the sense that they have an incredibly unique sound. It's ubiquitous to sound because it's all over the place, but the products themselves, the Nord range, they have a real identity of their own, and were right there at the beginning of Virtual Analog back in the mid late 90s. And as far as I'm concerned, for the most part, indeed, of the Virtual Analogs stand head and shoulders above the rest. Just listen to the oscillators. When you're listening to a Virtual Analog synth, switch all the effects off, switch all of the delays, reverbs, listen to the oscillators, and listen to what you're paying for. And they have done a great, great job in that. Although they are now putting effects on them. That was always a way to judge the quality of the instrument, is take all of the extraneous stuff off it and just listen to the oscillators. You wouldn't demo a Gibson Les Paul through a £50 effects pedal.
if you're
putting effects and judging synths on there that have got built-in effects, then you're not listening to what you're paying for at all. So then that's the Nord Lead 4. So the final pick here does stray away from the synths bit, but obviously we're going to allow this one through, being that it is a synthesizer.
An analog synthesizer as well.
Indeed.
It's probably the most used analog synthesizer and most appreciated analog synthesizer that's ever been built, although it's not making musical notes. It's Roland's TR-808. And years ago, I used to work with a very famous Japanese drummer called Gota Yashiki, who built all of the original beats for Soul to Soul, worked with Bomb the Bass and things like that. He knew the guy who designed the bass drum circuit from the 808.
All right.
And he popped in one day with this guy who was visiting from Japan. And we kind of sat and worked out just kind of proper back-of-the-envelope maths that if he had 10 cents or 10p from every single sale of every record that had his kick drum on it, he'd be the world's richest man.
Easily.
If you think about it, it's on more records. The sounds of the TR-808 are on more records than any other instrument in musical history.
I'd go with that.
Whether it be someone just even layering an 808 kick underneath another one just to do it, but you think of hip hop and you think of the records that were made there, and then you think all the way back to the classic 808 loops that were all over Jam and Lewis's productions, Marvin Gaye productions,
Michael Jackson.
It's everywhere, and it's still there 35 years later.
And it's everything from banging techno to sexual healing.
Yeah,
you know, the cross genre. Mm-hmm. That sound is, you know, you can put a pattern on that, and you can be rocking along to some sweet electro at 130 BPM. Smack it down to 78 BPM, and you've got some sweet soulful loving happening.
And the resurgence of trap, the surgence up of trap has suddenly brought the 808 sounds again in a much more processed form, completely back. But I was absolutely shocked about how little the samples of an 808 actually sound like an 808 until I actually had one in this room and started playing it. And then it's very easy to appreciate why. When you look at the waveforms, everyone is slightly different. Kick drums are all fairly consistent. But I think we have a thing built into our brains that we can tell samples. We can tell when something's repeated. So if the same sample is triggering every snare drum or every clap sound, we can actually almost detect it. But when you have a fast hi-hat pattern, if you're triggering it directly from an 808, it sounds natural. It sounds like it should do.
And well, there's so much going on in the hi-hats. That's where it's clearest for me when you listen to it. Instead of a glitch in the matrix kind of machine gunning sound, and which you rightly touch on, it sounds like an 808, but it doesn't. It's not an 808.
Yeah.
And there is no substitute.
And I'm still amazed that no one's managed to do a proper analog circuit of the cowbell.
Square waves, isn't it, detuned?
I've got absolutely no idea, because even on the bearing in mind, I love the recent Roland TR-8. I think it's a fantastic machine, especially seeing they're starting to upgrade it with some of the older drum machines as well, like the new 707 pack, etc., etc. But the cowbell sound in the TR-8 sounds nothing like a cowbell from an actual TR-808, and it's just bizarre.
It's the hats where it's at. There is so much going on if you just have a simple going on. You listen to the amount of wash and phase that's happening in it. It's like when you just fire an oscillator off on a Moog, whether it be a Model D or a modular. It's the kind of thing you just listen to all day, because there is enough variance in it to keep the ear interested and the mind interested that you just don't get from the machine gunning of the sampling. They've done a great job of that. You're absolutely right in TR-8. It's very, very close, particularly with the hi-hats, where there is so much of that going on. But there certainly is no substitute for that boom. And boom indeed, these are drum machines that the residual values of which are just going up and up and up, where a lot of the big three, if you like, 808, 909, 303... the 303s and the 909s seem to have more or less plateaued at a price point that increases around inflation, whereas the TR-808 is just carrying on like a skyrocket. You're looking at £2,500 for a really like A1 condition one these days, and it's continuing to go up to 2728. I've seen them go for.
Really? Sell.
And I think that's a lot to do with all of the genres that we've talked about, that they're, you know, there's a thread of 808 going through, but particularly hip hop, with the growth of that, particularly across the water in the States, it's just becoming more and more popular. And a lot of people, when the TR8 came out, goes, well, the TR808 values will go down because of the TR8.
Yeah, in fact, I saw them go up.
Exactly. It just brings it into the modern consciousness even more.
Yeah.
And the value of the Mona Lisa doesn't go down because somebody makes a print of it.
No, that's a very good analogy, to be honest. And I would say, as an actual creation, it is. It's one of the best technical creations that's ever been made in music, I think.
Indeed. I'm lucky enough to have one myself. And, should the house ever be on fire, I'd probably grab thing first before. Sorry, guys. But yeah, that's the truth there. So we're going to let you have one other piece of wildcard kit. So you're the equivalent of the Desert Island inanimate object. What would be the other piece of hardware that you would have in your little Desert Island studio shack?
I had a really good think about this, bearing in mind that we've agreed on all of this, that we only have rudimentary recording facilities. And I was thinking something character, something with a nice reverb, something that you can distort things with, something you can get some depth into. But actually, one of my favourite pieces of equipment, which is why it sat directly in front of me in the studio, is a very quite unknown piece of equipment from a very well-known guy. George Massenberg created a company called George Massenberg Labs in the 80s and started releasing bits of hardware, and his EQ is very, very well known. It's the one with the multicolored knobs on the front. It's a brilliant mastering EQ or program EQ, and because of his attention to detail and his engineering skills, they're just everything that he came or developed by that company was fantastic.
But that was the bit of kit I expected you to bring.
Well,
the EQ.
I love the EQ, but nowhere near as much as I love the box that's next to it, the dynamic gain control. Now, he doesn't call it a compressor. He calls it a dynamic gain controller. And it's basically an incredibly advanced compressor that uses psychoacoustic principles, in other words, how our ears work, to actually do the compression. It's not a character compressor. It's not going to add that kind of valvey punch to anything. It's not really going to change the sonics at all. It is literally controlling the levels. But the reason I selected it is that I've never come across anything like it, because you'd think that something that didn't build character in would be characterless.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the complete opposite. This thing adds soul to anything that I've put through it. If you put a piano through it and you set it up correctly, suddenly it sounds like a recording. Even a dodgy piano sample will suddenly come to life. It makes vocals come right to the front without being overly processed or overly pushed. Particularly synths, it just kind of delves into and allows you to really control the front and release portions of them, as well as making them just sit within a record correctly. And it's because he's done the circuit design in a psychoacoustic way, so it's actually designed to respond to our ears. And I'm sure if aliens came down, they'd think it was absolutely disgusting sounding unit, but then they'd probably hear MP3 and run off like a mile. But because it's tailored to the human response of music, it's for me one of the most important things in here.
And so is that your bread and butter? Is that, do you track through it? Do you find you use it more in post? Is it a mastering thing?
Everything.
Everything.
So if I'm ever recording vocals, that's on the end of the chain without a shadow of a doubt, because you never know what someone's going to do. Even the most controlled and experienced vocalist may do something crazy. I can keep control of that, but I can also create a usable vocal that is fairly transparent without tons of compression artifacts on it. Whereas if you bung it through any of the other stuff, if they do something crazy and they hit the attack portion of the compressor, it's just going to squeeze it to bits and you're going to lose something. This will do that. It's got basically three detection circuits: a peak detection circuit, a fast detection circuit, and a slow detection circuit that you have independent control of. It can work in fixed ratio or in variable ratio mode, and it just sounds like nothing else. That's the only way you can put it. It just makes everything sound a bit more recordy when you shove it in there.
Absolutely, ties everything together. Mix glue.
So and it's just individual elements as well. You put a fast sequence like that for something that's coming out from an analog synth like a Jupiter 8 that can be sometimes quite difficult to control. If you've got it in stereo, there's going to be bits firing all over the stereo image. Whack that on top of it, and all of a sudden, as I say, it sounds like it's been through. It just sounds like it's been through a recording studio. Amazing thing. Steve Mack told me about it. That's the house Steve Mack, and he swore by it for years. He actually sold his. And then
I was going to say, did you get that one off him?
No. I got that completely separately. He came in, took one look at it, and went, "Oh my God, I've forgotten how much I love this. Quick, get a breakbeat up." And then we got up some shocking old vinyl break, shoved it through that, and we just looked at each other and went, that is amazing.
The leveler.
It's fantastic.
Well, that's the GML Model 8900 Series 3, for the record. That was James, your desert island.
That's the
kit.
Stuff. I would shovel over to a desert island and be perfectly happy to sit there for a long period of time, providing, obviously, we've got a decent power outlet.
Well, that would be it. You'd get there and you'd have forgotten your four box. That would be me. I'd be there, or I'd have no headphones. Well, thank you, James, for taking the time to record this podcast with us for the GAK Special Edition Desert Island Synths podcast. It's been a pleasure discussing a small portion of your, it's fair to say, vast collection of equipment.
Thank you. Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Always good to natter about gear.
Indeed. We could carry on all day. I certainly could in here. We've barely scratched the surface as far as I'm concerned. But thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time.